Do you have, without suggesting Joe was in a particular corner and Tim in another, but do you agree that that Tim has fairly characterized Chief Justice Marshall's rationale for working through to the conclusion he did in that case?
Well, I'm not sure if Tim has contradicted himself and just what he just said about Justice Marshall and sort of getting back to being successful in getting back to Marshall's characterization of native property rights. And I think that's probably there's an ambiguity really in that decision as to exactly what Marshall meant. There's language in the decision that says that it alludes to conquest as a source of rights upon which once they descend, the people upon which they descend are power cannot controvert those rights. I guess I tend to agree with Tim's earlier characterization of the Marshall decision, and that is that it does not grant or affirm as a matter of domestic United States law any title, any property, complete property interest in Aboriginal lands in the United States. But it sets up a kind of divided property interest, if you will, or contingent interest that the United States has in Indian property, and it is simply the right to acquire native lands, presumably with the consent of the native people. And that, of course, is the doctrine. Well, the consent by purchase, a just war, which those are very difficult to define, and or abandonment.
They define them, don't they?
Yeah, that's the problem. So I think that that's the Marshall. What my understanding of Marshall's doctrine is just that it does not establish as a matter of domestic law a absolute right to land that permits the United States to take it or have already taken it simply because these adventurers of Europe landed on the shore, and Marshall rejects that doctrine. That discovery gave complete title to the discoverer. One more point. Interestingly enough, that doctrine that Marshall rejected is the very doctrine that is applied in Australia. And Australian Aboriginals, because of the domestic law in Australia, coming from the British Empire, without a revolution to intervene, denies native property at all. There is no Aboriginal title in Australia at this point in time. I'm rambling here, but I want to get back one point I guess I want to make, and that is that I have often wondered if we in the United States are not at the end of the development of these doctrines of Indian law, and I too am beginning to question how maybe I'm beginning to question, whereas Tim has already gone past that point, how useful these doctrines are when it comes to advocating native positions, because we're beginning to see constitutional reforms in places like Canada and Australia that seem to, and they're very nascent beginning, we don't really know how far they're going to go, but they seem to offer broader vistas and a more fairer adjustment of relationships between peoples than do the domestic doctrines of Indian law in the United States. Well, I'm not sure if I've answered your question or just really used it.
No, I just before we come back to Joe, could I ask Ralph Johnson, do you want to comment on the Chief Justice Marshall?
Well, I can't improve upon David Case's and Tim Colder's analysis. One point to make is that case was designed to protect Indians, in a sense, from the encroachment by non-Indian hucksters and charlatans who were trying to get at Indian land. So in a sense, at that point, it was a protection device. But I'd like to speak to a larger question, really. That is, it seems to me the underlying perception that Tito Naranjo has spoken to Tim Colder and many others is that we are not approaching a final solution for the Indians, and that is the final solution being the assimilation and disappearance of the Indians. And that, if you want to characterize the problem in the United States with regard to constitutional policy, legal policy, whatever, is the underlying assumption, and that is the Indian problem will go away because Indians will disappear. They won't disappear. We hope to God they don't, as other groups will not disappear. We should have, we ought to have, we will have a society that accommodates many diverse cultures and viewpoints. When that assumption disappears, then we will begin to think about constitutional doctrine that does what Tim Colder is saying. It lives on, it accommodates people's real interest, the Indians' real interest in continuing forever, as long as they please to continue. And it's that perception, it seems to me, that underlies the whole works and should be. I couldn't do any more than just heartily endorse Tim Colder's position and Kim Gottschalk. Both of them have very strong validity and should be pursued.
Joe Jorgensen and then Rosita Worrell. Forgive me, I just thought we had exhausted those things and then return to you.
Well, we're on to what I want to talk about anyway. Following the Menominee Restoration Act, it took a few years, but in 1978, Congress decided that there should be some means by which tribes that were not recognized, Indian peoples who were not recognized, could be recognized. So it goes by a number of names: status clarification, federal recognition, federal acknowledgement, and so forth. But monies were made available by Congress to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and Indian peoples who wished to be recognized, hence possibly become available, make available to them federal benefits, particularly such things as the Self-Determination Act, the Child Welfare Act, and so forth, were allowed to conduct research to demonstrate that they in fact were Indians, that they were a tribe, and they should be recognized and should be considered for incorporation under the benefits provided by the federal government. One group, the Lower Muscogee Creek Indians of Georgia, went through the process of doing research on itself and then making a case to the Bureau of Indian Affairs that, in fact, that they were a tribe. They'd been intact since well before 1830, and that they were due to be recognized as a tribe and to receive benefits. The Bureau of Indian Affairs evaluated this case that was made to them, and they said, first, you don't demonstrate your genealogy. Second, you don't demonstrate that you're Indians. Third, you don't demonstrate that you've been intact here for the past 150 years. And finally, we're not going to acknowledge you. And their reply was, it was rather difficult for us to demonstrate that we were Indians on any state rolls because it's against the law in the state of Georgia, and was until the 1970s or so, to identify yourself as an Indian. That came from the Indian Removal Act and from President Jackson's refusal to uphold the decisions made in the Cherokee cases. So the response, the question that was posed to the Lower Muscogee Creek is, what are you going to do? And they said, well, look, we're Indians, we're a tribe, we've been here for hundreds of years, we intend to stay here, and no decision they make in any way will influence our religious practices. It won't in any way influence the way in which we conduct ourselves as a tribe, and it won't in any way influence how we view ourselves towards others and other tribes with which we participate. That the point is only this, that it's not going to go away, the idea of a tribe, the idea that people who have lived together and share things in common together will continue together. They're there, and they'll be there. That these people too, who've now been working through the federal acknowledgement process, and there are many, there have been seven or eight tribes that have been recognized in the past 5 or 6 years, will become part of, I think, a movement that has already begun to not only recognize them as tribes, but of course to get land back for them. So ANCSA is the worries about ANCSA and movements to do something about it can perhaps join with a much, much larger movement throughout all of North America that has these very serious constitutional implications. Finally, the last point is that I hate to say it, but I don't think we're in disagreement about the impaired rights that are defined by Justice Marshall. When I read the case, it was clear that he wasn't going to take on land already patented in fee. But he recognized there was a problem in those patents. It was also very unclear as to what would be done with land beyond the areas already occupied, that were occupied by Indians. And it was at a time, of course, when the United States was just expanding and still didn't have much of the Southwest. It was still not in its ownership. So that a number of questions that have been raised about Indian land rights actually have been raised since this decision was passed. The impaired right did look to me as if the claim by the federal government is that only it can purchase the land from Indians, and they were protected in their occupancy and use until such time as the government decided to buy it.
Rosita Worrell.
My question might have been answered when I went outside to put money in my parking meter. I guess the law goes on. Just an anthropological observation and a footnote. Just from the discussion here between the lawyers, it's really easy to see why Indians see that their fate lies in the hands of lawyers most often. The anthropological footnote is that the Tlinkets rejected the principle of discovery, and as a matter of fact, the other thing that they did, and I think this is what Tito has really pointed out, is that Indian peoples have utilized Western institutions to protect themselves. And in the Tlinket case, they, in rejecting the principle of discovery, still went to Congress. They hired a lawyer, okay, this is in 1867, they hired a lawyer, and they said to, through their lawyer, if anyone is going to purchase Alaska, then we, or the Tlinkets, or the native people, must be the ones who are going to sell. And so they said, you have paid your $7 million to the wrong people. It should be paid to the native people themselves. Well, anyway, they weren't too successful, but they did make that effort. But the thing that I want to point out is that native people have utilized Western institutions to protect themselves. And I think Tito really demonstrated to us how they can deal with Western institutions that come in. I think that Native people are going to be caught up in running back to Congress, trying to protect themselves, in this 1991 issues. And so it might be that they will be caught up with these smaller issues, which are really not smaller issues, in terms of land alienation and the non-enrollment of Native children into the tribes or corporations or whatever we may call them. The question that I have is, while I don't think Native people are abandoning, the larger ideas, the ideals of justice, they are caught up in protecting themselves, and so most of the time they act in response to these immediate concerns that they have, such as 1991. And I'm intrigued, by the idea. I guess I've also, as a scientist, have accepted, what's happened under the principle of discovery. But I'm intrigued with the idea that perhaps that the United States didn't have, or this lawlessness, that the taking of land without any national principles. Just the basic question I have is, who's doing anything about it right now?
A lot of people are doing things about it. That's really the basic thrust of the Black Hills claim matter, the Shoshone matter. There are lots of them that Joe Jorgensen mentioned. You see, I think there's just a distinct difference between the position you're in if you're asking for a better handout as compared to the position you're in if you're saying that you, Alaskan Native people, have been treated fundamentally wrongly. Because in the latter situation, you're demanding what is rightfully yours. In the first situation, you're simply asking for something by grace. And I think there's always a limit. People are just not willing to listen to somebody coming around constantly asking for another handout. It reminds you of the person on the street that you see every day, always wants another quarter. And it's not a demand made as of right. And it just seems unfortunate to me that Native people in the lower 48, all over, constantly find themselves led along, usually by lawyers, in a position of asking for a handout rather than demanding what is rightfully theirs, and in fact ought to be lawfully theirs. Fortunately, we're seeing more and more of the effort to get back what's right. I mean, the Black Hills case is like that. The Sioux people are in a position of saying they have a just and moral claim to the hills. We're not simply asking for something in addition to what Congress has already given us. And they're being listened to because, of course, they're right. You're right. And that matters. It really matters. And it's just a shame not to exploit that and build on that. I mean, the Menominees were right. They were doing it. They weren't... I don't know if I'm getting at what you're saying or what you were asking about, but that's a quick reaction anyway.
I thought it was just a lawyer's response. No, well, I mean, I just wondered if there was anybody, I mean, such as your institution, your organization, that was, you know, really pursuing it in a methodical,
oh,
you know,
well,
well-defined.
I mean, I could brag about my office. I mean, we do that all the time. You know, take the Hopi matter. We could be practical and admit that, well, we're not going to get all that Hopi land back, and we might as well take the $5 million. But the Hopis don't seem to want to be practical. I mean, that land isn't going anywhere, and neither are the Hopis, and they're just going to sit it out, and it just doesn't matter if it takes 100 years or 200 years. They're going to do it. We're trying to help them manage that, because they're in a position where, like many others, they could be destroyed without, you know, if they're not terribly careful. Because one of the things that will wreck, or that will permanently destroy, an otherwise just and powerful claim, and that is free, voluntary acceptance of some settlement. That is devastating. If you honestly, freely, voluntarily accept a resolution of it, very few people are going to let you come back a generation later and reopen the books. I mean, in other words, consent will do it. The claim won't go on forever if there really is consent to a settlement. And the terrible thing about, say, the Indian Claims Commission is this appearance that there may have been consent to accepting that money in exchange for the underlying right to the land. And of course, that's the most potentially devastating thing about ANCSA, is the suggestion and the popular belief that Native people here consented to it. Because that will put an end to the basic underlying moral claim. And that's why I asked Ada Deer to talk about that question in relation to the Menominee Restoration, because somebody had just thrown it to me a week or so earlier that, well, the Menominees had consented. Well, we found out they didn't. So, yes, I mean, my office works with, well, heavens, the Western Shoshones, the Seminoles, Hopis, Sioux, Six Nations, and more. But I don't mean by that to brag about it. There are lots of lawyers and others out there working, but I think you're wrong to put too much emphasis on organizations and lawyers, because if it was up to the lawyers, you'd all be dead, really. The lawyers have been guilty. Even Congress said a century ago that they had to put a stop to the godless robbery, and that's a quote. being practiced by the lawyers on Indian people. It is just awful. Very seldom do the native people themselves make that kind of gross mistake. The Sioux were very explicit. They wanted the Black Hills back, and it was the lawyers that went in and filed a claim for money instead. It was not a mistake by the Sioux. They made no mistake at all. And so it goes. And now I'm finding out that the same was true up here. The native people up here were not, did not do the things that Reader's Digest would have us believe as regard voluntary acceptance of ANCSA. I think the beauty of all this, and it wasn't lawyers that pressed the Menominee Restoration, so it goes. Most of what's good about the survival of Indian people is what the people do in spite of their lawyers, contrary to what their lawyers might have led them to do. The Western Shoshones have done nothing if not struggle to overcome the perfidy of the lawyers that have claimed to represent them. So don't get overwhelmed by this idea that lawyers have got to handle all this. It isn't so. I mean, I can see from the nodding heads around here that the people have known these fundamental things much more clearly than the lawyers ever have. Lord, if we'd left it, I mean, you see what the state of the law is, but the people knew better. So,
Russell Jim and then Kim Gottschalk.
Thank you. I find this very enlightening. I hope the next two comments doesn't create any controversy, or perhaps it is not criticism. But it surrounds the basic human rights, and this right that is trying to be created by the indigenous people of this North American continent and perhaps out the world. And a lot of it seems to center around race. But were you to segregate bathrooms in the United States and say, okay, this bathroom is for Indians, you'd have many indigenous people saying, well, it's about time. And the other comment would be in regard to the Bolt decision again. This reference to the court giving the tribes 50% of the fish. You have many Indians, many indigenous people, specifically in the Pacific Northwest, that are saying, Mr. Bolt gave away 50% of our fish. Now that has large implications international-wise, and I'm hoping some of the questions, such as Rosita's here, will be answered next week, and I'm sure Mr. Doug Sanders is competent to do so. And the World Council of Indigenous People is one body of people that is working towards the creation of indigenous rights. Be they it unconstitutional in the United States of America or not. But it seems that the United States of America insidiously has a policy of assimilation of indigenous people throughout the world. And I'm sure it's going to be addressed next week. And I'm glad to hear Mr. Coulter refer to the international basis and concerns. And I agree that this forum here is a very important forum, and I'm hoping my contribution and all our contributions will be heard throughout the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jim. Kim Gottschalk.
Yes, I just wanted to reiterate a couple of the statements that were made about being careful of your attorneys. I don't think that can be overemphasized, and I think a little background on the way the Indian Claims Commission work probably is enlightening. Namely, as I understand it, the Indian Claims Commission does not have authority to adjudicate questions of title. What would happen is there was arrangements in the statute for the attorney's fees to come out of the settlements. To get an award, you had to show that some Indian property rights had been taken. And so there was an incentive for the attorneys to look back over history and find action that constituted a taking. Therefore, giving the tribe a right to money and the attorneys a right, a way of collecting their fees. And so there was a built-in incentive in that act for attorneys to find, in many cases, or to interpret historical facts contrary to the best interests of their client. And I think whenever important Indian issues are at issue, you have to be careful at what possible interests your attorneys have and make sure that they're both going in the same direction, because in many cases they're finding, when you look back with a more objective view, that there was nothing, for example, in the case of the Western Shoshones, there was no evidence that the United States had in fact taken those rights. And an interesting question is raised as to, if in fact nothing did happen to take those rights, does the fact that the attorney stipulated that something did happen to take those rights constitute a taking by a forum that had no power to do it? Maybe some of those claims still exist even after the claims were paid. But it is true, be careful of your lawyers and make sure that they don't have an incentive to accomplish something that's not in your own best interest.
Rosita Worrell?
I didn't mean, first of all, to put lawyers on defense. And also, I would suggest that Indian people have, you know, through their history, have, you know, are really have arrived at that state where we understand the importance of lawyers and their positions. And I think that's probably why Indian people are sending a lot of their own people to law school now.
Did you want to add anything, Tim, before we move on?
No, I'm content. I think people have made some marvelous observations.
Well, Rosita Worrell, you did want to add something.
Yes, I was thinking about this earlier, and perhaps now I could raise it as a question. I think, again, Tito's discussion really brings it out, the differences between Indian law and Western law. And again, this is, as I understand it, you know, not being a legal theorist, but being an anthropologist and understanding at least Indian law, and have made some attempt at least to look at Western law. And I don't know that that's been, the reverse has been done, where we have legal theorists looking at Indian law. But again, you know, I guess if there is a thread that runs through all American Indian and Eskimo groups, there is this recognition of this spiritual relationship between people and animals, that animals and the earth have spirits. And so Indian laws regulate that interrelationship. It tells us, you know, what they should do and what they can't do. But in Western law does not seem to accept this kind of relationship. And Western law seems to regulate interaction between human beings, between humans and property. And so for Indian people, what they have done is to go to Western religions, and again, the protection of the freedom of religion, have protected themselves in their religious belief in those domains. But sometimes there's a restriction where Western religion does not accept, you know, the relationship between animals and human beings. And I mean, I think a good example is the subsistence law, the state subsistence law here in the state, which basically gives priority to subsistence use whenever an allocation has to be made in a limit. Subsistence use takes priority. So even though there are many instances in which subsistence involves a religious activity, it was clear that in the subsistence law, Native people couldn't include this religion aspect in the regulation. And I think the closest that they got to it was defining this religious relationship in the subsistence law as customary and traditional taking. And maybe I could, you know, get some of the lawyers here to comment on, you know, just, you know, what they have observed in Western law and in that, you know, protecting that kind of relationship.
Tim Coulter, if you
well,
want to.
Well, I'm afraid I can't offer very much that's useful other than to point out that Western legal concepts, both in terms of domestic law of various nations and in terms of international law, just does a terrible job of dealing with that relationship and protecting those interests. You said it. It just does not take into account those things. In fact, there's been some exploration of that problem as a theological, metaphysical matter in that somewhat famous Law Review article, Should Trees Have Standing? He's really wrong about that. It's not a question of whether trees should have standing to bring a lawsuit. The question is whether the trees and, you know, it's just a manner of speaking. What he meant was should the animals, should the I don't know how you think, but the various life forms, including the waters and so on, should they have legal rights, and should their relationships with people and with other institutions be a proper subject for the law to deal with? And really, Western law just does not come to grips with that, and it's probably going to be native people who force that upon the consciousness of the Western world anyway. When there was a first meeting at the United Nations in Geneva back in 1977, the chiefs of the Haudenosaunee or Six Nations Confederacy used their opportunity to speak, as they said, in behalf of the four-legged ones and the winged ones, as they say, because they were rather upset that they weren't there, that no one, you know, they were talking about human rights, and that seemed kind of twisted or a little strange to them. And so rather than just talk about their rights as native people, they spoke for those that weren't going to be heard. And that was just a little effort to try to open that up. You know, most of the people who heard that thought, well, how quaint, you know, isn't that neat how these Indian people think? So you have to kind of shrug and hope that they'll wake up a little. But starting to happen, other than that, I can't really make any further observation. I mean, the law is terrible on that.
Any David Case or Ralph Johnson, do you want to say something? That was Christopher Hughes' article, I think, that you mentioned, wasn't it? In any event, carry on.
My comment is
Stone.
Stone. There is a body of cases that speaks to the question of Indian rights to exercise religious practices which are in violation of either state law or tribal law of a particular tribe or federal law. Some of the more well-known ones involve the use of the peyote button, and those cases have generally come down on the side of saying that even though the use of peyote may be in violation of California state law or Navajo tribal law or whatever, that the peyotists may continue to use it because it is a central part of their religious exercise. In other words, the religion, it is not peripheral, it's not marginal, it's a central part of the religious exercise. The question has arisen in two cases, at least in the last 3 or 4 years, with regard to some of the Pueblos which believe that a mountain or an area in New Mexico or Arizona is sacred. That mountain or area is held by the Forest Service and is used as a ski area, and the Pueblo wanted to stop the use as a ski area or limit it in some way because it violated their religious precepts. And you have a conflict there between the Constitution's Establishment Clause, that is the clause of the Constitution that says that the federal government shall never allocate particular resources, land, or money for the support of one religion. And the Establishment Clause would then seem to say you cannot designate these mountains for the Pueblo's religion, because to do so is using federal assets for the support of one particular religion. On the other side, you have the contradictory, countervailing legal doctrine that says that everybody is entitled to exercise freedom of religious exercise. And the Indians are entitled, the Pueblo is entitled to free religious exercise. So you have a clash between those two principles. The determination of that clash comes down to a balancing by the court as to whether the place, the mountain, or the peyote is central to the religion that is to be exercised. And I must say that the results are not always happy, because you frequently have a Christian or Judeo-Christian person, a person of that culture anyway, who is making a decision about Indian religious practices and may not understand the depth of feeling that the Indian tribe has about that particular religious thing. I'm always struck by the fact that in the United States there is no major Christian, maybe except a Mormon temple, no major Christian place where it's terribly important. But I'm always reminded, what if Christ had been crucified in Kansas on a little hill? Would we find some way to designate that as a religious, the allocation of federal funds and so forth, protect that? I suspect that constitutional doctrine would accommodate that change. If you look at what happens in Jerusalem, you find that the Muslims feel that Muhammad ascended from a rock in Jerusalem. You find that the Jews feel that is the central holy place, and you find that the Christians feel that that's the central holy place. And the place is worth hundreds of lives, thousands of lives all the time. People shoot each other all the time to get control of Jerusalem. But we don't have any such Judeo-Christian places in the United States, and so it's difficult for the dominant culture to understand that animals, that places, that mountains, that trees have true religious significance. I think that's a perception that has to be changed, what Tim was talking about.
Wish I'd said that.
Yes, I wish you had too. Might I be permitted to remind you that and Ralph Johnson mentioned this yesterday, there's been a real advance in the law of native rights in the United States, and if I may say so, in Canada as well, during just this last decade. And in Canada as well as in the U.S., there were no law professors teaching native rights until the 70s. Because nobody thought Native people had any rights that were worth studying. And now there are courses, there are law professors, and these doctrines through law review articles, as Tim Coulter mentioned, and by other means find their way into the judgments of the courts and the understanding of the public. I think I can illustrate that all of this does make an impact. By referring to what Russell Jim said yesterday, that the Yakima Indians had just in very recent years obtained an acknowledgement that a sacred mountain of theirs should be restored to them. Tito Naranjo referred to the restoration of a sacred lake to the Pueblos in just the last few years, and the Australian delegation that will be coming here next week will no doubt tell us about what happened there. I think just a few months ago, Ayers Rock, a sacred place for the Aboriginal people of Australia and occupying the dead center of the continent, the government of Australia has now declared that it is going to restore Ayers Rock, which is, it's really a kind of a mountain, I think, to the Aboriginal people of Australia, so that the point that Tim Coulter was making, it seems to me, can be demonstrated in events that we all have heard about just these last couple of days, and which those of us, like Ralph Johnson and I, who go back to the 60s and even, God forbid, to the 50s, when we turn back, can see this movement in law, in politics, in political philosophy. And that brings me, I think, to Ralph Lerner from the University of Chicago, who's a professor of philosophy there. And Mr. Lerner, we would like to hear from you now, and we're all yours.
Your introduction compels me to make a series of disclaimers. I am not and have never been a professor of philosophy. I am not and never have been a lawyer. And I am not and never have been an Indian expert. Okay. In addition, there's the complication that Mr. Chamberlain and I have been charged with the crushing burden of representing the humanities in all their glory. And I won't speak for him, but I feel my vertebrae collapsing under this weight. What I've done, I've been interested in certain aspects of early national policy toward the Indians. I was interested in it as a white man's question, and thought about it. I did some homework some years ago on that matter. I've read the papers that were commissioned for this conference, and I've tried to pay attention as closely as I can to the things that were said here. I think my position is rather different from a number of sentiments and assertions that were made here, but I probably the best way to enter into that would not be to say, well, I disagree with X about that, I disagree with Y about the other thing, because we'll just have assertions sort of passing one another in the night and it won't make any difference. But rather to suggest another way of looking at it. And to the extent that I say some things that that will strike you as contentious or dubious or even dead wrong, I fully expect that you will not have lost your tongues and that you'll speak up. And like Mr. Coulter, I don't incline toward the soliloquy, though I'm perfectly prepared to indulge in it. But I think it would probably be better if we just opened it up in this way. Now, reading the things that have been distributed and reflecting on the paper that Ms. Fineup Reardon had written for the earlier session, I'm inclined to think that the question that's stirring people most and to which they find it extremely difficult to give an answer is the question, what's an Indian? It's a very hard question to answer, and of course it has nothing to do with whether it's quarter blood patrilineally or some other way. I mean, that kind of mechanical resolution has almost nothing to do with what's stirring people, with what accounts for the depth of feeling and the passion and the terrible worry that comes through all these remarks. You see it in that first paper where the author speaks of it as a in terms of a dichotomy between full participation in the society and self-sufficiency, suggesting a kind of queer division that in fact simplifies life rather than mirrors it. Another point that she mentions there has to do with what I would call, I think she uses the term a couple of times, pride. That's connected with a sense of separateness, that these people are somehow different, distinct, somehow have a fate or a destiny of their own. But in some listing that she gives there, quoting some testimony from 1968, and suggesting a whole list of things that Indians... Is it permissible for me just to say Indians and as a kind of code word for Indians, Eskimos, Aleuts, and so forth and so on?
Yes,
okay.
Certainly.
If it's not permissible... But I'm not talking about Alaska Natives simply.
We've got lawyers out there, watch out.
Indigenous people, okay. Or Natives, is that okay? Is Natives all right, or does that smack too much of the British Empire? Natives is simpler. I mean, I would prefer to use an Anglo-Saxon word.